If only you could be independently wealthy beyond anyone else in the world. If only you could have all the women, or ladies, men, you want. If only you could be the most famous person in the world, but not be bothered by the media. And that you would have no chance for your enemies, or there'd be no chance for your enemies to say anything against you. You're dreaming, of course. You would be, but not Solomon. Solomon, the king, fit this category. He experimented this for us because if you'd ever think that if you only had this, then you'd be happy, Solomon already covered that base for you and can tell you it doesn't work. It doesn't matter. This book of Solomon in his, well, what we could say is he's got a serious disconnect with God and is trying to measure life as it fits in this temporal plane. He's trying to figure out the meaning of life and what the purpose of life is and make sense of it all and find reason for it without considering eternity. And he's coming up empty. From time to time, he has some glimpses of things that are valuable. But for the most part, he says, all is vanity under the sun. In this life, all is vanity. Now, he does give us a glimpse of truth. In this chapter, he isolates one very important truth, the value of relationship. In the midst of the vanity of this and the vanity of that, he does say, here is some value. And so let's jump in and see what he has for us. He says in verse 1, then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. Remember that phrase. If you're with us here, we've already seen that emptiness of the temporal life expressed in chapter 1. We've seen the emptiness of the eat, drink, and be merry philosophy, the Miller time philosophy, we would call it, in chapter 2. And in chapter 3, we saw already that the fact that God has hidden eternity in our hearts. There is nothing outside of the Lord that can truly meet the need. And now he is expressing his concern in looking at all the oppression that is done under the sun. He says, look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. It bothered him as he looked around and he saw stronger people taking advantage of weaker people. And yet, of course, this wasn't just true in his day, was it? This is certainly true all over the place in every time. But then he goes on to say, on the side of their oppressors, there is power, but they have no comforter. You know, we have one of the best legal systems in the world, but there's still the truth, the axiom that if you have enough money or friends, you can beat the rap. You can get away with murder. You can break the justice system. The guilty are released oftentimes on technicalities. The weak are overpowered by the strong. The innocent are preyed upon by the corrupt. And we cry, that's not fair. Yet Solomon is saying, not only do the oppressed have no comforter, but even those who are oppressing, and they have their power, they still have no comforter. It doesn't satisfy them. They're miserable in the doing it just as much as the person who is getting the pressure is as miserable experiencing it. So he concludes, I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still alive. Great conclusion, Solomon. How would you like to have this counsel in verse 3? Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. How would you like to go to a counselor and they said, you know what, after hearing your story, I think they'd probably conclude that you would have been better off not having been born. Solomon, again, is not seeing a way out of this. He's trying to measure it. He's seen from the standpoint of the oppressor and the oppressed, and he's like, you know, it better not, you might as well not even exist in this world. Because he's only seeing this temporal glow. He's only measuring life under the sun. But it also amazes me is that Solomon himself was one of the greatest oppressors. In the record of 1 Kings, you find that he actually oppressed more than others. He was the one that put a lot of pressure and created a tremendous load of slave labor in order to increase his building projects. So much so that when finally the people under the burden of his taxes and his pressures were relieved when he died, they came to his son Rehoboam and said, hey, give us a break on this and we'll follow you. He oppressed. And you know, the amazing thing is you can be something and not see it in yourself. Isn't it true that your sin looks quite horrible on somebody else, doesn't it? that you don't see yourself. In fact, we can sit here in a service like this, and the sad thing is that for a number of you sitting here, I would be willing to wager that you're hearing quite effectively, but not for yourself. You're hoping that so-and-so is getting this. You're thinking of someone who I really hope they're listening to this. And there's a good number of you that may be doing that, and you're doing exactly what Solomon did. He goes, I can't believe how bad it is out there, and he didn't know he was part of the problem. He goes on. Verse 4, he says, again, I saw that for all the toil and every skilled work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Now, it seems like his lament was, after you work so hard, then your neighbor envies you. That's not exactly what I think is the expression here, because it's almost as if the envy is part of the motivation. In other words, read it this way, that for all the toil and every skill for work, a man is envied. He's toiling, he's working, he's laboring to be the envy of the neighborhood. He wants to be envied. He likes the fact that people are looking at him and going, whoa, I'd like to be like him. I want to be like Mike Jordan. You know, be like Michael Jordan, be like Mike. That's the key, you know, and we emulate that because, and of course, for someone in that position, it's their flattery. Someone wants to be like them. Someone wants to be them. Interestingly enough, in the first few verses, you see the oppressor and the oppressed. In these next few verses, you see the achiever and the lazy man who doesn't achieve. Notice verse 5, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. On the one side, you got the achiever, but he's motivated by envy. And envy is a powerful motivator. You know how powerful it is when you think about it. This man is achieving with strife and rivalry. He's working really hard because he's got to have more than the other person so that others will look at him. And, you know, you get this house and your neighbors, ooh, that's a beautiful house. You got the best house on the block. And then some other person moves in and they build a bigger one next to you. And now everybody goes, sorry, you're not on the top anymore. That house is even better. And it burns you up. And what is it? You've got to get a better house now. You've got to do more. I saw this same thing happen in my children when they were young. It's a dangerous time, Christmas time, when you're giving those gifts out to the little ones. And I noticed, I wish I had this on video because it would have been such a great little thing to show. Of course, my kids would have killed me. But I remember them opening their gifts. And usually, you know, you try to have one open them first and then the other, but that often doesn't work with kids. And usually when you say open, it's like they're both just scrambling open those gifts. They want to see what they got. But if you ever noticed, they've got one eye on what they're getting and the other eye on what their sibling is getting. And so they're looking at, they're opening up and they're, what'd they get over there? And I tell you, if in their mind, they've got a calculator in their mind. They know how much this cost compared to that. They know the value. And let me tell you, if you've shorted them a little bit, they're going to be so unhappy. Even if it's a gift they wanted, if their sibling got more, they're going to be upset. I see this happen all the time. It's all a matter of how relative it is to others. Why is that such a powerful motivation for us? You have a number of people pressing on to get the best, but then you've got the backlash to that. You've got this next person, the fool who folds his hands. That is an idiom, a Hebrew idiom, to say he's not doing nothing. He's just going to kick back. He's too lazy to do anything. Or perhaps the motivation is, in his mind, he can't be the best, so he's not even going to try at all. Do you know how many people fit in that category? See, they're proud, just as proud as the achiever, but they've tried and they can't quite meet the standard that someone else has, so they don't even want to try anymore. They just give up. They go, well, I could do that, but I don't care. You know, I'm just going to kick back. He folds his hand, but he ends up consuming his own flesh. You see, the overachiever has plenty of things, but hurts others in the process. Where the underachiever, the fool here, the lazy one, doesn't have even enough for himself, and he's hurting himself. I think in this category, unfortunately, there are more people who fit. Because a lot of people have this pride in the way that, well, they've heard a good speaker or they hear a good musician or they see something perhaps in the church from a spiritual standpoint. And they they know they can't ever reach that level. I know that Pete, in doing the worship ministry for a long time, had the most difficult time of getting other teens. I'd go to Pete and I'd say, "Hey, Pete, you know, my friends in California, they've got churches half our size and they've got three or four worship bands and all these different people involved." And he'd go, I know, but I'm trying. I want to develop people, but no one's coming forward. And I began to talk to different people in the church that had musical ability, and I would hear the same thing all the time. "Well, I play, but I could never play that good. You know, Pete is just so, I mean, he's so up here and I'm down here and I could never, so I don't even want to try." And I think, you know, how many people are in that category for many other ministries? They think, you know, "You've raised the standard here at Calvary Chapel and I just don't know if I could meet that standard." Well, you know what? You don't want to be this guy who folds his hands. And you're not profitable. You're not experiencing the joy of serving the Lord. Because you know what? It's not about ability as much as it is availability. When you make yourself available, God will use you. He'll help you. Now, the overachiever has the motivation of envy, and that's a powerful motivation in ministry too, unfortunately. And Paul lamented over that with the Philippians. He said, "You know, these, I know there are some out there preaching Christ for envy and for strife. You know, they want to, they've got ego needs and they've got to be noticed and they've got to be recognized, and so everyone looks at them." And I'll tell you, you know, I don't think that, honestly, there are a whole lot of people that begin ministry with absolutely pure motives. I don't think any of us fit in that category. I know when I first desired to be used of the Lord, it was because I saw somebody else being used, and I thought, "Man, I want to be used like that." So I was a little envious in a sense. But, you know, the amazing thing is when you begin, the Lord is very effective in ridding you of those other motives. And he can do it painfully sometimes, I might add. But it's necessary. Because that should not be the motivation. We should have a passion and a drive to serve the Lord and go forward, but not for our own gain, not for our own purpose. But we shouldn't lag behind either, like this fool who's not doing anything, the lazy person. He's not even pressing on. And he's hurting himself, much less not being a benefit to anyone else. So I want to challenge you in this respect. God has given you gifts. He's given you abilities. You may not even know what they are. They may be latent, and because you haven't exercised them and employed them in serving someone and serving the Lord and serving in some area. And I want to exhort you to do that. Find out what your gift is. The only way you can do that oftentimes is by getting involved in some capacity, and you learn as you're going. But you have to be humble. You know, you have to start somewhere. You can't, no one starts at the top. But again, we're so impatient with this. So he balances this out in verse 6. "Better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind." Do something. Be content in what the Lord has given you, but do something instead of striving for envy and other things and toil and grasping for the wind. But notice now in verse 7, he comes to something that's very powerful here. He says, "I returned and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all of his labors. Nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, 'For whom do I toil and deprive myself of good?' This also is vanity and a grave misfortune." Here's the overachiever again, but he's such an overachiever, he's such a workaholic, that no one really is even around him. He has no companion. No one to hinder his progress. No one to slow him down. He's going for it. But he never stops and thinks, "What am I doing this for? What am I killing myself for? All for the sake of being noticed, to have a street named after me when I'm gone? To have someone say, 'Oh yeah, one time I remember him in the annals of history.' What is it?" I remember years ago, as an associate pastor in California, a man came in for marriage counseling. It was commendable that he was there, but it was because he'd come to the end, and usually guys don't come forward and admit there's a problem until it's already way past the opportunity to touch anything in it, unfortunately. But he did come at least, and he said, "You know, my wife wants to leave me. She's had it with me." I said, "Well, why?" "Well, you know, I don't really understand why." And I says, "Well, what is she telling you? Let's start there." It often happens this way. "Well, she's saying that, you know, I'm spending way too much time playing chess." I says, "Playing chess?" He goes, "Yeah, I'm a chess player." I go, "Really? I'm a chess player. Are you any good?" Because no, I'm really good, and I'm really good because I spend a lot of time. I'm in a number of different chess clubs, and my goal and my dream is to become a grandmaster. I said, never mind, I don't want to play you. But I says, wait a second here, you want to be a grandmaster, huh? He goes, yeah, and in order to reach that level, I've got to play at least 8 to 10 hours a day. What do you do for work? Well, I work, but I really love chess. And I go, I guess so. Well, I found out that was the issue. Every night of the week, almost, he was playing chess. And she'd had it. And I says, I see the problem here. You know, to be a grandmaster, quite honestly, you're going to have to get rid of the wife. Because there's no way you can be a grandmaster and be married. And forget about your children, because you're not going to have time for them. You want to be a grandmaster, you're going to have to pay the price. See, now you're going to have to practice even more than 8 to 10 hours a day. Let's step it up to 15 or 16. Because I really like to see you be that grandmaster. Because just think about it, you could be the grandmaster of chess, the best player in the world. Now, you won't have any friends, you won't have any family, you won't have anybody around you, but boy, you'll be the best. And he got my drift. And he had to make a choice. What is most important? Solomon points something out here. Here's a guy who's alone without his companion, and he's toiling, he's laboring, he's depriving himself of good so he can succeed. But he says this is a grave misfortune. What a terrible tragedy. Why? Because Solomon goes on to say, two are better than one. See, we think that we're going to succeed if we get every distraction out of our way and we're going to go forward and I can't stop for wife or children or friend or anything to succeed in my goal. Quite honestly, in the world today, if you want to be the best, you are going to have to pay the price. If you want to be the best basketball player or the best baseball player or the best, you know, at your job or at the best at anything, compared to everyone else in the world, there are some people that are going to sleep 1 hour less than you. There are some people who are going to deprive themselves of more good than you. They're going to really diet more. They're going to push themselves more. They're going to lift more weights. They're going to do this and that. There's always going to be somebody that's going to do more. So you've got to push yourself to the very limit, which means you need to get everything out of your way. The problem is you end up shortchanged. It's a grave misfortune because two are better than one. Because they have a good reward for their labor. Now, Solomon has said, all is vanity. All is emptiness, futile, frustration. Because that's the Latin word. Frustration comes from the Latin word frustra, which means in vain. It means it just doesn't make any sense. It's not going to work. But then he comes to this and he says, this is good. This is a reward. That is, there is value. That's the word there, reward. There's value. They have a good value for their labor. Notice why. He says, for if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Do you know, from a spiritual standpoint, this is extremely true, because who is it that Satan comes to stumble and to tempt? He comes to the person alone. Came to Eve in the garden when Adam was not around. And he'll come to you. He came to Jesus when he was alone and was in the desert, in the wilderness. And he'll come to you alone. Now, there are times when that aloneness is necessary, but woe to that person who has no one to lift them up. You know, this is where people start falling by the wayside, when they get isolated from other people that are close enough to them to call them, wonder, hey, where are you? What's going on? What's happened in your life? I haven't seen you. You know, sometimes people play a dangerous game. They come to the church for a while and they make a lot of friends, but they really haven't made friends like they think. They have a lot of acquaintances here, but no one really that close. Because then they stay away a little bit. They wonder if they're appreciated, so they stay away at Sunday and then no one calls them, no one asks about them. They come back next week and no one even missed them last week. And then they stay away a couple more weeks. And then 3 or 4 weeks, and it's then a month, no one calls them. They find I don't care about those people. They don't care about me. They've played a dangerous game now, and now they're isolated and Satan has them right where he wants them. Problem is, this companionship, does it just happen? Does this friendship just take place? Is it spontaneous? Is it just, okay, we should have friendships? You see, we're accustomed to looking at the world around us and thinking, you know, it happens like this. There's you fall in love at first sight, you have instant friendships. I mean, it happens in the commercials in 30 seconds. You know, you crash your beer mug against somebody else and there's a camaraderie there and we're together. 30 seconds time, you've got a great friend. In the movies, happens in a couple of hours. person meets someone, they grow very, very close in friendship, and they're together, you know, for the rest of, all in 3 hours, you've got this whole thing unfolded before you. In real life, it doesn't happen that way. It's not spontaneous. If you want a friendship like that, you're going to have to be willing to work for it. Work for it? Oh, yes. You'll get out what you put in. Friendships are like that. Now, it's important to know that this type of friendship, we could look at the various words in the Greek for love, and we'd come to realize, okay, there's eros, which is the passionate love, the love that Hollywood focuses on most of the time. Then you've got the phileo, the friendship love, and you know, the mutual give and take love. And then you've got agape, which is that new word that Paul coined largely, that in classical Greek was unknown, unheard of. It's that self-dying love, that ultimate commitment love. Now here's what happens, folks. We all want phileo. We want that mutual friendship. I want a friend. I want someone to be my friend. But there's a foundation for phileo that has to occur. And this is also very applicable in marriage. You know, a lot of people get married in the eros, and they've never really developed a friendship. Then they find there's a lot of things they don't like about each other. And then that becomes a source of frustration. There will be. Your partner is going to annoy you here and there. And that is a real troublesome thing when you don't have a foundation of agape. And here's the secret. As a Christian, you've experienced agape. You've experienced God's unconditional love for you. He loved you so much that he died for you. I don't picture Jesus on the cross with warm, mushy feelings of emotion going, oh, they're just so wonderful. I'm going to just die here, you know. No, his love was a commitment love. It was vulnerable and much pain involved and suffering so that the goal of what was best for us was accomplished. That is salvation. This is the foundation we need in a marriage and in a friendship. Agape, commitment. I am committed to you no matter what. And from that foundation of agape, then you build phileo. Then you have the mutual friendship. And it's sweet. You know, I ran into a couple after the service last night. And it was a couple, and then the lady brought a friend of hers that she'd known for 30 years. And I says, really, you've been real close for 30 years? She goes, yeah. And I says, I bet you've been through a lot, haven't you? I bet you've been through a lot of misunderstandings. I bet you've been through some painful experiences where you had to say something painful to each other at times and you had to work through issues. And they go, you better believe it. We've been through a lot. And I said, you know what? And it's deepened you, hasn't it? See, this is what a friendship is. It's got to be, it's mutual, but it's got to have the foundation of agape, of commitment. Marriage, when you're committed, only when you say, I do, and that's it. And while the world is out there trying to redesign the wedding vow, I will love you as long as you tickle my fancy, as long as you really make me feel good, as long as you're continually beautiful and appealing to me. Great commitment. Even though they don't say it, many times they live that. And they fall out of love. I'm not in love with him anymore. I'm not in love with her anymore. Oh, really? What does that mean? All that tells me is that you're no longer committed, so you've got no agape. You're just wanting someone to be your friend. And marriage is 99% friendship. It is commitment, but the sweetness of it comes from the friendship. It is committed. I'm committed no matter what. I'll never use the D word. My wife and I, we can have our arguments and our fights, but I'll never use I'm out of here type of thing. That's foolish. That's the foundation. It takes work. But you know, in this type of relationship, see, there's a vulnerability. There is a vulnerability. You're going to be hurt by someone. Now, here's where a couple of things come into play. Proverbs 27:5, we covered this when we were in the Proverbs. Open rebuke is better than secret love. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. How many of you, in the last week... Now let's be generous. In the last month, how many of you have had someone in your life, without a show of hands, I don't want to put you on the spot, just ask yourself this question. Have you had someone, anyone, tell you something negative about yourself? Something that they didn't like, something that they think you need to change. Now, if you can say yes to that, that's healthy. That's very healthy. Because it tells me that you're close enough for people to be able to say that. It tells me also that they feel comfortable enough to tell you, which is a good sign. But if you can say no to that, that's a dangerous sign. That tells me you're either completely isolated or you have made all your friends understand in no uncertain terms that they had better not say anything negative to you by your previous reaction. They're not about to chance saying anything negative to you and to ticking you off because, woof, you know, you don't want to say anything to so-and-so. That's not a friendship. Friendship is when you really do have someone close enough to be able to not be afraid to tell you something about yourself. Now, here's where we come into challenge. I might be speaking to some of you here and here speaking about this aspect of commitment, and you might be crying on the inside going, you know, I would die for that. I want that type of friend, and I want to be that way. But here's two issues from two different personality sides that we're going to have to face with this. What I see sometimes is that you've got the certain type of personality that just seems to be extremely outgoing. They're just the life of the party, you know, they've always got the witty remarks to say, and everybody likes to be around them, and they've got all these types of friends around them. The challenge for that type of person, however, is the fact that, well, they can tend to be a little shallow. They're really not that deep with any of those friends because they're too busy flitting from one friend to another and being the life of the party and having fun. But when any time anyone ventures to say something negative to them, they go, yeah, that's nice. I'm glad you're here. I'm going over here, you know, and they're out of there. Then you've got the introvert type of person. The person that, I mean, it's hard. I mean, you might even, I've talked with some of you who've been here for a year and you still haven't made friends. And, you know, the challenge there is, yeah, you got to take a risk. You know, we're so afraid of risk. We're so afraid of rejection. We're so afraid that someone's not going to like us. So we can't even go out and meet someone because we just don't want to be rejected. And so we stay in our shell and we don't get out. Now, the good thing about the introvert is once you do make a friend, you're a deep friend. You're a friend for life. You're going to be there. You're going to be committed. Friendships don't come easy. You're going to cherish the ones you got. Well, the extrovert to you, I would say, deepen your relationships. Stop being so shallow. You've got to make some serious commitments with a number of individuals, a few of them that you can really be accountable with. To the introvert, I say to you, take some risks. You know what? So you'll be rejected. You'll be joining Jesus then. We'll all be it sometimes. Someone's not going to like us particularly, and you might have to reach out in a number of different ways before you find your niche. You know, I find that from my own personal experience, my background, I'm more introverted, and I've had to take a lot of risks. But being as a pastor, I'm put in a position which just the position itself makes me out more. And therefore, now I have the temptation on both sides. I've got to be careful. I don't spread myself so much out there. And quite frankly, I have done so. And I've hurt people in the past. I've given the impression I can be there for you. I'm your friend. And then not being able to because being so spread out. And it's a challenge. But you know what? The Lord was convicting me about this and for our fellowship as well. And you know, depending on the personality type you have, you know, it's funny. People will come in here and I hear both sides of it. I hear people say, it's just so cold at Calvary. It's so hard to get to know anyone. It's just real difficult. And then I've heard, man, this is such a great place. Everyone's so friendly and exciting. I've just been warmly welcomed and accepted. And those are contradictory. But not really. You see, it's all different sides of a person's experience and maybe personality and maybe the way they look at things. But, you know, we've got to stop evaluating others on this basis. We've got to stop listening to this passage on behalf of someone else. In fact, I had someone come up to me after one of the services and said, so, you're going to be a better friend to me now? And I said, you know, you just failed the test. We're supposed to be evaluating ourselves on this right now. You know, the point is, and that is very true, we so easily just look out instead of, Lord, what do you want to do in me? I want to be a friend. And this is the challenge. It's got to be work. There are great benefits in this brotherhood, in this sisterhood. He goes on to say, again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can anyone be warm alone? You know, there is a benefit in that commitment that you're there. Because if you're here, you're not over here, you see. You've made a commitment to be here. Now you're not over there, you're not over here, you're here. And yet the benefit is now you're warm. Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. You see, Satan will try to isolate you and attack you, but you've got two or three together there now. And of course, the threefold cord is an interesting paradox. You got two, but you got a threefold cord. Some translations have tried to read into this that there's a third person here, another person into the mix. Well, yes, there is, but I think that the subtlety of this is that that threefold cord is the person of the Lord. Where two or three are gathered, Jesus says, there I am in your midst. When you make commitments on that agape love toward that friendship, what takes place is the one who made you is pleased with that because that's what he did. And he's there, right present in that. He's there in that commitment. He's not in the shallow commitments that you make. The, if it's convenient, I'll be there for you commitment. If I like it, if I'm, you know, pleased in this direction, then I'll be there. But no, he's in the commitment no matter what. And when he's there, that threefold cord is strong. Now, how does that threefold cord work? Well, Jesus said, greater love has no one than he who lays down his life for his friends. He modeled it for us what it should be like. But more than that, you see, there is a sweet thing that happens in this threefold cord, not easily broken. A braided cord is much stronger. It's more than three times stronger than three individual cords together. See, if you had three individual cords and you added the strength of those three, they would not be as much as the braided cord, the cord that's intertwined together. It's an interesting thing how that happens, but each of them gives strength to the other in a kind of an interesting way. I remember reading an illustration. I came across an illustration about a horse pull competition in which the winning horse was able to pull 12,000 pounds. The second place horse was able to pull 10,000 pounds. Just for fun, after the competition, they hitched the two horses together and they wanted to see how much the horses could pull together. They figured, well, you got 12,000 here and 10,000 here. That's 22,000 pounds. So they put 22,000 pounds on it, and they found that the horses were easily able to pull that. So they put more on it, and they got up to 30,000 pounds, and the horses were still able to pull 30,000 pounds together, where individually they were only able to pull the 12 and the 10, which is only 22,000. So there's something very interesting that takes place when two are together. And the Lord is in the center. That threefold cord is very powerful. I do pity the one who does not have friends around them close enough for accountability, for prayer, for encouragement, for, yes, even rebuke at times. Because without that, you're alone. You're isolated. And you may be accomplishing your goals. Well, what good is it if you got no one to share with? You see, wealth is pretty empty if you have no one to enjoy them with. And problems are pretty small when you have a companion in life. Friendships. And whether they be friendships in the marriage relationship, which is so important, or friendships that you've got a few friendships in your life that there's mutual accountability. If you're not involved in them, I really exhort you to take some steps to change in those areas because you will not benefit from this. Notice he goes on in verse 13 to say, better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. You see the problem here? Solomon, almost, it's almost like a little biography or autobiography here. He's almost talking about himself here because he had accomplished his goal. No one was going to tell him what to do. And he's not going to be admonished by anyone at this point in his life. It's a temptation for anyone who is successful to think that they cannot hear or learn from anyone else. Because essentially what's going to happen is, though it says he came out of prison to be king and though he was born poor in the kingdom, in other words, it doesn't matter how obscure where he came from, now he's king. But even if he came from that, now he's being replaced. It says, I saw all the living who walk under the sun, and there was with the second youth who stands in his place. And there was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Now, the translation of this is really choppy. It's hard to really get the thrust of this. But essentially what it's saying is you got this wise or this old foolish king, but he started out as young and he didn't know anything. And now he thinks he knows everything and he's not going to be admonished. But soon he's replaced, he's put out of the way by somebody else younger, and the same thing happens to them. And eventually afterward, no one's going to respect him either. And you have this thing that happens, and you know, in the ministry it happens and it's kind of odious. You know, we start out humble and small in our own eyes. And then somewhere along the line, we think we know something. And we talk condescendingly to people. Yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah, I know that verse. Okay, yes, next, you know. And we think we're something. God help us if we ever come to that. I pray as a pastor, I never become an old and foolish pastor who can't be admonished anymore. I don't want to be this, but I also see the tendency for many of us to move in that direction. And we move in that direction not only in our lives and ministry, but we move in that direction in relationships. We get to a point where no one can tell us anything anymore. And then we become useless to anyone else. We're quite happy with ourselves and no one can tell us anything, and we never know anything about ourselves that we need to know. You know, the Bible says through love, serve one another. That's our motive. That's our desire. We need to serve one another. We need to be thinking of ourselves as servants, that my life is here to make someone else's life happier and better, and that's why I'm here. Jesus came not to be served, though he was the Son of God. He came to serve. And that's how we should all look at our lives. I'm here for someone else. I'm here for someone else's happiness, someone else's joy, someone else's encouragement, because, you know, when you finally figure that one out, you realize, without even looking at it, you found your own joy and happiness in giving your life away. And that's the secret. I got encouraged with a letter that I'd received. This was actually a couple of years ago, and I found this in one of my files. It was a letter that was sent by someone that didn't come to the church here, but the letter says this. This check, they were sending a little donation. They said, this check is sent in appreciation of the man in the blue pickup truck that plowed our driveway. Please thank him again, and if he does the work, I'd be glad to have him back and pay him to do our whole driveway when it snows. Again, thank you. I'm thinking, you know, here's a person who, you know, they saw a need out there. They helped somebody out. They didn't even think of it. They didn't even let them know their name or address or anything, but she knew that it was somebody from the church, and so she sent the check into the church, and, you know, it was for $50,000, so whoever had the blue... No, I'm just kidding. It wasn't. Whoever has the blue pickup truck, you can claim... No, I'm just kidding. It was a small donation, but just in thanks for, you know, the act of kindness. And, you know, this is really what God wants to do in all of our lives. You know, we get so self-centered and self-possessed. I have my own agenda and what I want. And I want a friend, and I'm frustrated when people aren't my friends. Well, you've got to be that. This is what the Lord wants to do within our lives. He wants to produce this in us. Otherwise, we become just that old and foolish person that eventually is put on a shelf, and the Lord will use somebody else. He will. He's going to get his work done. I am confident the Lord is going to fulfill his work when it comes to getting us into a new facility that we can reach out in a more effective way. But I also wonder if it's not going to be through people that have, not thinking that they've arrived, but people that are just continuing to seek the Lord. I really sense that there's a great many things that you hear in a service that you really don't hear. Because that's nature. It's human nature. A servant is not changed by words alone. You're not, for the large most part, you're not going to pick everything up you have. You might hear it, but you don't hear it. I know for my own life, growing, I grew more when there were individuals that challenged me and egged me on and asked me, how's my devotional life? And asked me, so what's your checkbook look like? Do you give to the... In fact, I got to tell you, I heard messages on tithing right and left. I just, you know, never thought about it. You know, and the offering would pass, I'd give a little and think, that's cool, until one person actually pulled me aside. Do you know what the Bible says about tithing? I was, yeah, I think I do. I've heard that message. But I never really related it to something I needed to do. When it came to my devotional life, they said, you know, are you getting into the Word of God in the morning? I'm like, well, I get to it eventually during the day, most of the time, sometimes, frequently, often, maybe. But it wasn't until that individual challenged me to make it an every day that it was happening. See, you hear these messages, but I'll tell you, unless you have people in your life close enough to challenge you, you're not benefiting. You're not benefiting from this two, which is better than one. You're not benefiting from someone that may see you and knows you and wants to challenge you to that next level until you're close enough. Then you're going to benefit. Outside of that, you won't have it. You know, in the world, in our transient environment, we don't even hang with our neighbors because we don't have to. We got cars, we can go to somebody else. We don't even have to get to know them because we've got friends out there. And if we don't like those friends over that city, we can drive to another city. And it's like we go from place to place to place, and we're going to find those people that make it easy on us to be a friend. But think about it. A couple hundred years ago, when you basically had to make it work in the village you were in, you had to be committed. You had to get along with people that you wouldn't normally get along with. You know, here God has put us together as a body. I mean, we're so different. Different culture, many of us, different background, different ages, different races, different whatever it might be, but we're one body, we're one in Christ. And the challenge is to really, when we get a friend, like when we challenge for home groups, I hear comments all the time, well, you know, I don't particularly like that home group. I like this one over that in the other city. And you know what? Maybe God wants you to be in a home group with people that you wouldn't normally hang around with because you sharpen yourself that way. There's so much more you can learn. Yes, you can have your friends out there to do things with, but in a home group, in the body of Christ, you're going to learn the process of love and of commitment. I want to challenge you on that. Not just be a Sunday morning Christian, but to get more plugged in because two are better than one.